Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Hey guys, Toby Mathis here, joined by, I'm just going to have to do this right up because usually it's Jeff, but we're not going to have Jeff today. What are we going to do with Jeff? So we're going to put a big X on Jeff and we're going to change him with somebody who is younger. There we go. We got Tony. Hey, Tony.
Hi.
So you're on the right Tax Tuesday, but you don't get Jeff today. Jeff is home recovering from some surgical procedure of some sort on, was it his tooth or something? Or I guess the eye. Oh, that's right. It's his eye. I have to make fun of him. You can send your questions in at any time to taxtuesday@andersonadvisors.com. We'll either answer them right away, flag them to be put on to the Tax Tuesday, the live course like this, or we just, you know, we forward them to a staff if it's very personal, especially if you're platinum, then we'll actually get through. And Tony, you do a lot of platinum, right?
I do.
Yeah, so she's answering questions. You have a pretty good-sized staff that just answers questions all day, right?
CPAs, tax attorneys down there, plugging away.
Plugging away. So if you need a detailed response, then you need to become a client. This is fast, fun, and educational. We want to give back and help educate. So we're trying to give tax knowledge to the masses and make sure everybody understands them and quits being afraid of them because it's really important. So we want to make sure that everybody can understand what's going out there in the tax world. By the way, the IRS recently published its 2018 data book, which is way early in my mind. Usually I think we get them in the fall, but They're already publishing it. Then the audit rate's down to about 0.5% now. If you're scared of the IRS, don't be. They got bigger fish to fry than us guys who are just trying to do everything right. There's lots of folks out there doing things completely wrong, not even filing tax returns. So our job is to make sure that we're doing the best that we can, take everything that you're allowed to legally underneath the law and pay the least amount of tax. If you can defer something, defer it, but do it with your eyes open. So let's take a look. Hey, if you want to join us and learn more, you can always go onto Facebook, AndersonAdvisors.com Facebook. Please like us. And then AndersonAdvisors.com YouTube. There's hundreds of videos. I mean, you can spend hours and hours and hours, not just on my stuff, Clint, but lots of our attorneys, lots of our accountants, including Miss Covey here. You guys just did a bunch, didn't you?
We did.
Yeah. So it's always fun. You can always spend some time. Now, the questions we're going to be going over today, and there are a lot of them, so I'm just going to tell you right off the get-go, we are going to be cracking. I didn't realize how many questions I had selected. Must have been drinking, and we picked a lot. So how do you know if you're overpaying taxes with your LLC? We'll answer that. What are the most beneficial types of QRPs and LLCs for tax shelters? What every lawyer and every accountant wants to hear is you use the term tax shelter because everybody, that doesn't have a negative connotation. So
yeah.
How can we protect a special needs trust from probate? Do I always need to take a salary out of my C corporation? Can we get the same tax write-offs for travel and meals as before the Trump tax plan, which I assume you mean the Tax Cut and Jobs Act? If your home and car are under an LLC, does the business pay the utility and maintenance bills? I have rental properties already. Will they be taxed differently if they are part of a C corporation? Usually I file with my 1040. We'll go over all these fun ones. When switching your LLC designation to an S corp, what accounting changes should you make? Paying yourself unknown deductions? What is your opinion on investments in the oil and gas space as a tax mitigation strategy? I have a full-time job, W-2, and I do real estate investing on the side. How can we use property depreciation to deduct against the W-2 income? That's a fun one.
Mm-hmm.
What are common tax deductions that apply to real estate investors? After finishing a rehab with the intent to sell, what is the best way to minimize capital gains tax? Will an LLC help reduce rental property taxes? This gets fun. Which is more tax advantageous, a 1031 exchange or a charitable remainder trust? So that's somebody getting kind of crazy there.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And how often should you take a distribution from a holding LLC? Now there's two more. If you thought that was enough, what are the tax benefits for a real estate investor in Florida to use a trust to hold real estate? How should money flow from personal to business back to personal in the most tax efficient manner? So we got a lot to go over. Wow, we're getting all these questions. We already got a bunch of questions. All right, something that we were talking about. So I was going over these questions, as there's so many of them with Tony here. And she says there's a lot of these ones that it seems like the answer over and over and over again is it depends. And if you know, that's always the joke of why do people go to law school so they can learn to charge for those two words. One size fits all. We hear about this depends. Is there such a thing? And I always say no, but I don't believe that people listen to it. So I'm going to burn it into your minds with a simple image. There is no such thing. And sometimes if you want a one size fits all answer, that's what you're getting, which is not something necessarily good. I have Tony Covey here. Hi, Tony.
Hi, guys.
Yeah, your interesting pictures. That was your no one size fits all. So I'm going to make you guys watch that again just because I'm evil. This was, is there a one size fits all? Is that there's the answer is oftentimes an it depends, because what oftentimes happens is there's so many facts and circumstances that make it that change things. Like when somebody says, hey, will an LLC help me save taxes? The answer is it depends on how you tax it. So an LLC isn't a tax designation. It depends on whether it's ignored, partnership, corporation, C corp, S corp, all those things come into play, what type of activity. So I don't want to just say it depends, but there's no such thing as that. And sometimes if you do get a one size fits all answer, like, oh, it's always best of this, that's what you're getting. You're getting a unitard that may not look good on everybody. I'm going to get out of that because I've seen enough of that picture. All right. You guys think you have to see it often. I had that thing on my computer for about 20 years. All right. And see if you can tell which one was Michael Bowman. All right. How do you know if you're overpaying with your taxes with your LLC? Well, the easy way to consider this is if you're driving, and I use this example a lot, where somebody flies into Disney World and they go to, they fly into Orlando Airport. They grab a rental car and they drive to the airport. And if they follow the signs, they're going to hit about five or six toll booths along the way. It's a lot. I might be exaggerating. It might be three or four, but it's a lot. And you seem to be hitting a toll booth every couple miles. Now, locals, or if you know how to use Google Maps and say avoid tolls, know that you can actually avoid any tolls by simply driving down Sand Lake Road. And Sand Lake Road, you avoid the tolls, but you hit a couple red lights. That's about it. So it might take you a couple minutes longer. How do you know whether you're overpaying? Just comes that you have to know somebody that knows the area and knows what you should be paying. Then you can tell whether you're actually overpaying. What you don't do is go to somebody who doesn't know that area. Like unless they're really well versed in it, like if they know business tax, go to a business tax person and say, hey, is this consistent with the other businesses you see? If somebody knows real estate tax, have them take a look at your return and they'll be able to tell whether you're on the toll road or whether you're on the no toll road. And it really comes down to this, that simple. People that know this stuff know it. If you don't know it, you don't. So how do you know if you're overpaying taxes with your LLC? You have somebody take a look. Now, if you guys have heard me over the last many months and years, we always make fun of people that say, well, I save tax with an LLC or I'm taxed as an LLC, because we know that doesn't exist. An LLC is a state designation and it chooses how it's going to be taxed by the IRS. So you can be a sole proprietor, partnership, S corp, C corp, whatever. You could have it ignored. So what it really comes down to is we take a look and you say, hey, what would you be best taxed as? So if you had rental real estate, for example, Tony, and you had some rentals, are you going to want to stick that in a C corp?
No.
Right. Mm-hmm. So how would we know if you're overpaying taxes? Well, we'd look and say, well, how is that LLC taxed? Where is it landing? We know there's a lot of benefits to having real estate. We don't want you to lose it. So how do we know if you're overpaying? Well, we look at the tax designation of that LLC and we compare it to the other choices. I used to say that taxes, there's three rules, and that is calculate. That's rule number one. Rule number two is a version of rule number one, which is calculate. And rule number three is way more difficult than the first two, which is calculate. Right. You just get a pen and paper out and you got to figure out which way is going to be better for you. Same thing as if you're doing retirement plans. You got to figure out whether it's worth it for you to save some taxes if you're going to pay taxes in the future, which would be like a traditional IRA versus a Roth. Would it be better to pay the tax now?
It's best to look at it on a quarterly basis.
Quarterly basis. From the accountant.
That's when you're making your estimated tax payments. So obviously, if you're going to be making quarterly estimated tax payments, you should be having your taxes looked at on a quarterly basis, or your financials looked at on a quarterly basis, rather.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you guys like to do?
Absolutely.
All right. So Tony, by the way, is an EA, which stands for?
Enrolled Agents.
And enrolled agents, who gives you that designation?
The IRS.
Right. So it's different than a CPA. CPA, that's a state designation.
State.
And then there's lawyers, which is also state. Mm-hmm. The only federal designation that you can get that I know of is that DEA.
Well, there's a few others, but it's not specific to tax.
So it's just for tax. The only one is, yeah, it's an enrolled agent. Mm-hmm. So you guys know, you learn how to do all the forms and fun stuff.
Absolutely.
And Tony, you've been with us forever, right? Well over a decade.
13 years.
She just started. 13 years. But so she knows her stuff. So what she's saying is do it quarterly. I say you look at your finances quarterly and make sure that you're not going off the rails. Because mm-hmm. it sucks when you get to the end of the year and somebody says, oh, I wish you had told me, right?
Absolutely.
You like having those conversations?
Those are fun. There's so many things we can do throughout the year for you if we just have the opportunity to look at it and play around with it, geek out with the numbers a little bit.
Yeah, somebody says, this is my first time hearing of an enrolled agent. Yep.
My feelings are hurt.
Yeah. Janice, this is interesting because I used to say, like, I like CPAs and I like EAs. I tend, but about 80% of the paid preparers out there have neither designation. And CPA doesn't mean, I don't want to say that. I don't want to say anything bad against the CPA, but you don't necessarily know tax returns and how to prepare taxes.
This is what they specialize. Not all CPAs specialize in taxation.
Mm-hmm. A lot of them are doing audit work, which means they're verifying the information that's creating the finances.
Right.
So if you're a big publicly traded company, you got auditors running around, what they're doing is verifying everything.
But then you have the CPAs like the ones we have here at Anderson who do specialize in tax.
Yeah, can't a CPA testify against you? Anybody can testify against you. Yeah, CPAs have some rules that almost that sometimes we fight with, where they have different masters sometimes. So Jeff's a CPA, he's awesome, he's amazing. But CPAs tend to be more conservative because not only do they owe you a duty, but they owe it, they have licensing issues too. And so you always want to deal with somebody who has a license. I'll just say it. So whether it's federal license or state license, what messes you up is when you have somebody with no license. And I'll get, like, honestly, there's some situations where you see somebody who's working at a fast food restaurant 2 weeks before they go over, start preparing people's taxes. And that scares me.
Oh, yeah.
And when the inspector general did a study, you don't have to take my word for it. Go read this stuff. We quite literally had a 0% accuracy rate on business returns on the paid chain preparers. And it was pretty ridiculous. Ridiculous. It's like, wow, 0%? 0%. It's freaky. Yeah, so the answer is EAs specialize in taxation. They understand the IRS forms, pubs, and codes.
Yep,
that's what they learn. So they're not going to go audit a company doing like a publicly traded audit. What they are going to do is they are going to prepare returns, and they know the federal laws, and they learn the state laws too when they're doing prep. But for the most part, what they really care about is the IRS.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, your state taxing agency is something different, but they obviously have to learn that too. Next question, what are the most beneficial types of QRPs and LLCs for tax shelters? This is always a fun one. So, you know, again, they say tax shelter, stop that. Like, that has a negative connotation, although I still like to say it too sometimes. All it's doing is, hey, what can we do to defer tax? So the beneficial types, it really depends on your activity. Mm-hmm. And just as like, remember, no size fits all, right? But QRPs, that sounds for qualified retirement plan. LLC doesn't exist in the tax code for as a taxable entity. So you could actually have an LLC that's owned by a QRP, and the taxation goes to the QRP, and then that QRP denotes whether or not you're going to pay tax later as to whether it's a Roth 401k or a traditional 401k, and whether it's subject to, you know, mandatory distribution or minimum required distributions. So all those things come into play. So the most beneficial types, I like things that defer taxes. So I like 401ks. As far as owning real estate, holding real estate, I'm going to have an LLC that is either disregarded to an individual or taxed as a partnership, which flows to an individual. If I am flipping real estate, I am either going to be an S corp, a C corp, or an LLC taxed as an S corp or a C corp, because when you are flipping real estate, it is considered ordinary active income. I do not want that flowing onto my return. Helter skelter. I want to be able to avoid as much of that tax as humanly possible for as long as humanly possible. You know, so those are some of those. Do you have anything you want to throw on there?
Not particularly. It's just when I look at questions like this, I'm with you. It just depends on what you're trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So You want to defer income. All types of QRPs are beneficial. It depends on what you're trying to do, whether it's you're doing it in the version of a Roth, traditional. So you have the Roth where it's growing, the income's growing tax-free, or you can defer the income if you're doing it in a traditional type of manner. Or maybe we're looking at a different type of, we're kind of going across entity types here. We're talking about QRPs, we're talking about LLCs, but what about a nonprofit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it all comes out like this. So again, we could do general rules. Mm-hmm. If you're not making much money, if you're below 25,000, for example, let's say it's your high school, it's a kid that's getting started. I'm telling them use a Roth IRA as a savings account. There's no penalty to take the money back out, only if you have gain on it, and they're not going to have much if it's only in there for a little while. But if it stays in there for a long time and you never pay tax on it ever again, you're in a really low tax bracket. So you're not trying to get a tax deduction. For example, the first $12,000 somebody makes, their college student, is tax-free. It's just, why mess around with that? And if I put that in a Roth and I let it sit there, and I do that every year, let's just say I put $1,000 in every year for 10 years and I never paid tax on any of it anyway, that $10,000 in, give it 50 years to ferment, you're talking about having hundreds of thousands of dollars tax-free. You know, so that's issue number one. What if somebody's in a high tax bracket? They're in California, they have state income tax, federal income tax, they have a little bit of a penalty with the net investment income tax. They have all these little things that are nibbling away at them, and they're really in a 50% tax bracket. Well, now you're going to look at deferring that, and you're going to be looking at 401ks. You're going to be looking at things like defined benefit plans. You're going to be trying to get that into something else.
Right.
Absolutely. So here, I'm going to make this volume up. Somebody says it's low. A charitable LLC, there isn't. There's just charitable remainder trust. We'll go over that. But a charitable LLC, not really. You're talking about a 501c3 or a charitable entity that does not pay tax. Like if I really want to, even if I am a high tax, I'm making $1 million a year. Well, I know that I can make 600,000 of it deductible with the stroke of a pen. That's what I know, because I could write a check to a 501c3, even if it's my own 501c3, and I could get a $600,000 deduction because that's what the code says. So I know I can lower tax, but you know, so there's different tools out there. But just as a rule of thumb, if you're buying and holding, you want it to flow onto your Schedule E. So you're going to make sure that it's going on page one or two, either disregarded LLC or a partnership. If I'm flipping a property, wholesaling, I'm a real estate agent, I'm more than likely going to run that through an S corp. If I have too much money, maybe a C corp. And then if I, especially if I'm in the $100,000 to $200,000 range, I'm adding a 401k, and I'm going to try to jam some money in there and defer. So anyway, kind of a open-ended question, but
yeah,
like
we could
those.
Go on.
Yeah. How can we protect a special needs trust from probate? So this is very interesting, and there's some pretty bad stories out there with special needs arrangements gone awry. And so the first question is, why should we protect it from probate? And what happens when it goes through probate? And I'll give you guys an example. Is out of Pennsylvania, where grandparents tried to give their special needs grandson money, and they skipped the parents, saying, hey, well, it really needs to go to my grandson because he's going to need care for the rest of his life. And the state of Pennsylvania took it all because they'd been providing care for the child since he was an infant.
Wow.
And you know, when their grandparents passed, the child was in his early 20s. So they just said, thank you for paying us back. That's if it goes through probate. Probate's really there to help the creditors, helps lawyers and creditors. So like, let's just say this, avoid probate. You use a trust to avoid probate. So then you say special needs trust. You make a living trust and you add special needs provisions so that when it becomes irrevocable, when you die is when that living trust becomes irrevocable. You already have the provisions in there that says to the trustee, don't give the beneficiary money if it's going to cost them benefits. So if the state is providing them benefits, give them the maximum allowance that they can receive on an annual basis without losing that benefit. So they're actually letting the trustee make a decision. If you set up a irrevocable trust where you give up all incidents of ownership, then it's not going to be probated anymore. So if I create a special needs trust that I have no say on, I'm giving it up and I'm going to have a third party manage it for the benefit of somebody who's a special needs individual, then I'm going to have those same types of provisions, but I'm getting rid of my ownership during my lifetime, then that would also avoid probate. Since if you don't own it, it's not going through probate. Somebody's asking a question that has to do with the last question we had, which was, I have several personal IRA accounts and want to convert them to a QRP in our real estate investment company. Can I use that money to purchase additional properties for investment rental income properties? The answer is yes in the QRP. So the QRP would be the buyer, or here's an easy one. If you have a QRP, you can borrow money from it. I can borrow up to $50,000 per participant, up to half of the money. So if I roll $100,000 into a QRP, I could borrow $50,000 out the next day. And I could use that to invest individually. So there's a couple different ways to do it. A lot of people like to invest inside the QRP. I'm not necessarily one of them, because I know that with real estate, I could avoid taxation for the most part. And if I put it in a QRP and it's a traditional QRP, eventually I'm going to have required minimum distributions. It's 70 and a half. I know I'm going to have tax. Let's see. Somebody says, I have owned a property located in an opportunity zone for a number of years. Is there any special tax benefit if I install a new roof? No, unfortunately, no. That's not how the qualified opportunity zone works. And a roof would just be added to your basis, and it would be depreciated over 27 and a half years if it's residential. If it's commercial, then it'll be over 39 years. But you do get a little tax benefit on whatever amount of the roof, the previous roof that you didn't depreciate. So you might get a little tax benefit, but no, chances are you're not going to get anything. Why did I answer that? I'm crazy. All right. Do I always need to take a salary out of my C corporation? Tony, I've been Hobarting this whole show, which you guys know I'll do. What do you think?
Well, you're not, there's no requirement.
Yay!
So the answer is take a salary out of a C corporation. Yeah.
So the answer is no. Do I always need to take a salary out of my C corporation? No. In fact, you don't ever have to take a salary. So here's how it works. Salary is just part of compensation. So I could pay you in cars. I still have to do withholding, yeah. But if I wanted to give you a car every month, here, Tony, here's a new Maserati.
I'll take it.
Yeah, but you have tax on it. You're going to have to pay the tax on it. You really want a new Maserati every month?
You know, I'll pay that tax.
You pay that tax. Yeah, you got to do withholding and stuff. Yeah, I can hear Patty cackling again. I can hear it through my wall. No, I'm just kidding. I have never taken a salary from my C Corp. That's good. We'd like to zero them out. In fact, 80% of them or so, mm-hmm. Probably more of ours. How many of ours do you think? Do you see where we actually pay a tax? We have thousands of returns.
Pay a salary?
Yeah, or do you see it where they ever pay a tax or pay a salary?
Oh, very, very seldom.
Yeah. So where you do, if somebody says, what if it is a lease? Then you have to pay tax on the lease value. So if I give Tony a car, the value of that, she's paying tax on. If I give her the car, it's the full value of the vehicle. If I let her use a car, then it's the lease value for her personal mileage. Mm-hmm. So if I'm a business and I say, hey, real estate agent, employee, here's a car. And 100% of that mileage is business. It sits at my office and they only use it when they drive clients around. Then that individual has to pay zero tax on it. It's all company. But if they drive it home and they drive it to on vacations and they drive it to pick their kids up and going to soccer games or going and doing whatever else, they pay tax on that portion. And there's actually a schedule that the IRS gives out. Yeah, it kind of stinks. How do owners receive a yearly salary from their businesses? Well, you pay it. So there's no rule under the federal law to receive pay over at a certain period. Like there's nothing that says you have to pay people biweekly. Your state may have that, and it's only certain employees. So if it's you pay yourself whenever. Mm-hmm. If it's somebody you hire, then it might be, hey, I got to pay them at least every other week or something like that. Every state's a little different. Don't you love questions like that?
I do.
Let's see. Somebody asked a question. This is going to be kind of weird. If I sell or finance real estate properties, can I be taxed on installments, or would I have to pay tax on the entire sales gain, even though I'm not getting the money right away? So Fred, you asked a great question. The answer is, it depends on whether you did a flip or if you're selling properties that you were doing buy and hold. So if I fix up a property and I sell it and I do it on an installment note, there's no such thing as an installment sale for tax purposes when I am a dealer. If I'm buying property to sell property, I don't get to, I can do an installment sale, but I have to recognize the tax the day I sell. If I am doing investment properties, so I have something that I've held for a lot of years and I'm just going to sell it to somebody because I'm like, I'm getting tired of owning it, then I can take that and I pay tax as I go. And I'm paying, part of it's return of basis, which is zero. Part of it's long-term capital gains, which is at whatever rate you're at. Could be zero, could be 15, could be 20%, depending on what your tax bracket is. Part of it's depreciation recapture, the 1250 recapture, which is your ordinary bracket capped at 25%. And then part of it would be interest, because it's a note and the IRS will impute interest if it's over 10,000 bucks. Mm-hmm. So good question, Fred.
Or you can still do the installment. And if you so choose, you can opt out and opt to recognize all that income in the first year.
Yep. And here's a good one. Fred responded with, do I have to designate myself as a dealer if I do fix and flips, or does the IRS designate me as a dealer? The IRS would say you're a dealer. The facts and circumstances make you a dealer. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter how long you hold the property. There's a case out there with a guy who held a property for 10 years, but his intent when he bought it was to sell it. Took him 10 years to sell it, and he was still a dealer. And it's taxed all as you receive it. So on that one, there might be a way to sell the paper. Maybe you sell it. Maybe you sell the note to somebody else, or you get a third-party financing company. So instead of doing seller finance, you get somebody else to get the interest on it, so you can get the money now. But it would more than likely be ordinary income.
Attention all real estate investors, business owners, stock traders, and anyone looking to get out of the rat race for good. We all know time is money, but did you know there's a wealth of resources on how to make more money, keep more money, and protect what you've earned, all for free online? Anderson Business Advisors YouTube channel offers free resources on asset protection and tax reduction from lawyers and CPAs designed to help you keep more money in your pocket. To learn how to limit your liability, protect what you've earned, and minimize your tax burden all for free, subscribe to Anderson Business Advisors on YouTube today.
Somebody says, I thought there was a way to write off a vehicle that's 6,000 pounds or more. How does that work? Alfonso, you can write that off. It's what they're doing is it's beyond the luxury car limitation. So a luxury car or a passenger car, you're really limited to about $18,000 a year. So if you buy a big old Suburban or a Land Cruiser or even the Tesla X, those are over 6,000 pounds. You could write the whole thing off in year one. The problem is more than 50% of it has to be business use, or you have to recapture that whole thing again. And that's good. You're on 5 years where you have to worry about that. Plus, as you receive the money, like if you're personally driving around that car, that's the same as receiving money and they tax you on it. So they say, oh, we look at the value of the vehicle, and then we assess you a portion. So it kind of gets stinky. Let's keep going. Oh, Martin asked a question. My buddy, I know who that is. Hello, what are the benefits of cost segregation? So cost segregation, there might be a question here that lends itself. Actually, no, there isn't one this week. But cost segregation, all we're doing is, so when you have, what is it, the Modified Accelerated Cost Recovery System, or MACRS, mm-hmm. normally I'm taking a house, like a rental property, and the IRS says, write it off over 27 and a half years. So this property, you're going to have to replace every 27 and a half years. So if I have a $250,000 house on a $100,000 lot that I paid $375,000 for, if you know what I mean, they're going to say, you can write off the $275,000 house over 27 and a half years. So that's $10,000 a year I take as a write-off. When I do cost segregation, I'm saying that house isn't just 27 and a half year property. It has carpeting in it that might last 7 years. It has paint on its walls that might last five. It has light fixtures and it has the switches on the wall, the panels, you know, all these things. It has thermostat, it has linoleum, it has tile, it has all these other things that have less than a 27 and a half year life. So you break those out and then you can write them off all in year one if you want, depending on the type of property. Mm-hmm. So if I buy a property, it's not a problem. I'm wondering if you have the bonus depreciation on stuff you've already had for a while. But I think you still can. Yes, you still write it off. So you're going to get, what I see is it's between 20 and 25% on cost seg. Is that, have you looked at a bunch of those, Tony?
I haven't.
All right. So what I've seen is it's about 20%. So if you have a piece of property that's worth $275,000, the improved value, so $100,000 in land, $275,000 in the improvement, I'd probably get an extra $55,000 deduction in year one, which is great if I can actually use that to offset my other income. If you're doing other things than real estate and you're not a real estate professional, then the passive activity loss rules say you just have to carry it forward. So it's going to offset your rents, then you're going to carry it forward. But if I am a real estate professional, then I could write it off against all of my other income. And a real estate professional, you guys have heard me say this a million times if you've been listening, real estate professional is a two-part test. You have to meet the 750-hour test, and then you have to meet the material participation test. So 750 hours in the realm of real estate, can be construction, you can be a real estate agent, and you have to spend sufficient time to be considered a material participant in your real estate activities. And that's per rental property you have, unless you choose to aggregate aggregate them as one activity. And the material participation, there's three tests, 500 hours, doesn't matter who else was involved, you automatically qualify. The lower end of that is you do all the work, nobody else is a property manager, then you automatically qualify. Or if you have other people managing, then it's 100 hours between you and a spouse, and nobody did more than 100 hours. You know, nobody did more time than you. So that's material participation. So anyway, that sounds like fun. Somebody asked, I have a commercial building I've had for more than 30 years. Cost basis was $150,000. It was depreciated fully on my personal taxes. I can sell today for $850,000. So congratulations. The building is in my personal name. Is there a method I can move the building to my IRA and then sell it? I don't know if you can do a, usually you're putting cash into an IRA. I suppose you could try to contribute something, but I wouldn't even do that. You can 1031 exchange it and just sell it, buy $850,000 worth of property. Or if you want to re-depreciate it and you want to lock in your gain, which is about, oh man, you're not going to have much in the way of, like, you're going to get nailed in tax if you don't 1031 exchange this. Yeah. Or you could invest it, you could sell it and then reinvest it in a qualified opportunity zone. Even if you do the opportunity zone, you just have a 7-year deferral. So you're still going to be paying tax on that. So I wish there was an easy way. What you may want to do if you want the deduction and sell it and not pay tax, John, you may put it into a charity as well. And so you could set up a nonprofit, get a huge deduction, carry forward the deduction if you don't have enough income to wipe it out completely out. You'd carry it forward up to five years beyond the year of the transfer. And you could get a nice big fat tax deduction. If the charity sells it, it pays no tax. So you still have the $850 in your realm, but it's now in a charity. All right. Let's go back to the questions we have. Somebody says, oh, how detailed do you have to be in tracking real estate professional hours? Use your smartphone and keep it in a calendar. That's how detailed you have to be. You just have to keep some contemporaneous record. I suggest that you use either a spreadsheet, or the easiest thing is just to use your calendar. All right. Can we get the same tax write-offs for travel and meals as before the Trump tax plan? Tony, they need to hear from you. Can you give them the answer to this question?
Well, travel didn't change. Your travel expenses are still going to be deductible the same as before. There was a change to meals. You still get your 50% deduction, but the employer provided meals did go down from 100% down to 50% with the rest. So,
ouch. So it used to be that if you provided meals to your employees saying, hey guys, work late, here's some pizzas. Mm-hmm. Used to be to write it all off. Now what is it?
50%.
50%. So at least you get something. Travel didn't make any changes. The big change for those of you who like to do meals is there's no meals as entertainment anymore. You cannot entertain a client. There's no entertainment anymore. I can't buy tickets to a baseball game and write them off. It's gone. Mm-hmm. If I buy them for a client and I give them and I'm not using it, perhaps I might be able to get by with a gift or an advertising or something along those lines.
Yeah, it's so limited in the deductible amount.
It's for 25 that bucks.
Per recipient.
Per year. It kind of sucks.
That does.
Yeah, so the entertainment went away. So what you always have to make sure is what you're doing is, it used to be, hey, I'm entertaining John Smith, potential client. No, I'm meeting John Smith to discuss business. It has to be what you're doing. It's all on how you do it. You can still entertain the client. The cost just went up. Yeah, John. That's about right. All right, there's still a way to write it off. You always look at it. You just can't write it off necessarily the way that you used to. So let's see, if your home and car are under an LLC, I keep thinking of Dorothy and like the witch who gets squished by a house.
No.
I don't know why I keep thinking, your home and your car are under an LLC, it just fell on them. Does the business pay the utility and maintenance bills? So this is a weird one. Honestly, I'm not a big fan of putting cars in LLCs unless you have a fleet of cars. Otherwise, I'm not doing it. But if the house is under an LLC, you'd have to have a business reason. The only time if I'm putting a house that's a rental property in an LLC, then yes. If this is your personal home and you're trying to protect the equity, then yes, but you're not getting a deduction for it. It's like the LLC could still pay it or you could pay it. It doesn't really matter. It's disregarded to you anyway. The car, just don't know why you'd put it in an LLC unless there's a business purpose. Somebody says, I recently heard if you send a gift to your office, I'm not limited to $25. So it says sending a platter of baked goods. Yeah, I don't know anything about that. Never heard that. But if you send it to your office, you're not giving it to a third party. Now you have, I don't know, baked goods for the office. That'd be a 50% deduction.
Might be.
Or you're just going to lump it into office supplies.
I mean,
sodas. You probably get 50%.
Yeah. But I mean, on this question though, I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, okay, well, if you did, let's just say you did put real property or an auto into an LLC for whatever the taxation of the LLC is, well, now it's an asset of the business, and now the business should be paying the expenses associated with those assets. Mm-hmm. And if you are paying those expenses personally out of pocket on behalf of the business, now again, depending on the taxation, what you have is you either have a expense reimbursement if we're talking about the C corporation, mm-hmm. or you just have capital contributions if we're talking about disregard or partnership. I mean, just looking at it directly, but again, like to your point, the real question is, do you really want to have that vehicle in the LLC, which can sometimes complicate things, and if not done properly, can result in more tax to you personally?
I tend to not like them in the LLCs, and I'll tell you why. Mm-hmm. Because your insurance tends to become commercial, and it's like twice as much. I get cranky when, because they're saying, hey, other people could be driving it now. It's an employer provided, you know, there could be other employees. So I tend to don't like that. And besides, cars don't cause liability. People driving them cause liability. So if I have Anderson Business Advisors and I buy a car in it, the car doesn't create the liability. It sits in a parking lot. What causes the liability is me giving the keys to somebody and say, drive around. And frankly, I'd rather be driving around as an individual than having a bunch of representatives of my company drive around trying to get me sued. So I'd rather not have that. Hey, get this. What are the details that I need to write down when tracking mileage for a business? So Alyssa, technically you write your odometer at the beginning of the year and at the end of the year, and then you're tracking miles. I'll just tell you, use MileIQ. It'll GPS you and use that. And it's so much easier. Don't even dink around.
It's super easy. It makes it much easier than.
Yeah, MileIQ.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so you swipe left if the mileage is ugly and swipe right if it's pretty. It's like an app. That's just horrible, isn't it? See, some of you guys know what that means, and you're all dirty dogs. Now, yeah, it literally it says if it's personal, you swipe one direction. Is it business the other? And then if you know, you don't have to write it down every trip. You don't have to write the odometer down every trip. It's once at the beginning of the year and once at the end of the year. They want to know how many miles was put on the vehicle. And what they really care about is they're looking for percentages. If you're a real estate agent, you say, hey, 100% for business, they're going to say, you know, BS. Nobody does that.
Yep.
You know, but if you have 65% business and it's your only vehicle, they're going to say, yeah, that's probably right.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're looking for. And plus, if you have 10,000 miles on your car and you rode off 16,000 miles, they're going to be like, no, what did you do?
Something's off.
Yeah. You heard about the guy. It was actually a lawyer who died. So this is a good story for you guys. So a lawyer died, goes to heaven. So yeah, no, this is bad. So St. Peter's up there and goes, what the heck's this lawyer here for? Right. Lawyer's kind of like, I know that again, this is a hypothetical guy. Right? So the lawyer died and went to heaven. St. Peter looks at him and says, hold on for a second. I got to get all the angels over here. Got to check you out. And the guy's looking at him like, why? Like, what, I got something on my tie or something? He goes, no. Brings all the angels over. And he goes, no, we haven't had anybody up here who's 323 years old. And the lawyer's looking at him kind of perplexed and thinks about it. And he goes, oh, shoot, you're going off my billables. All right, so I write off vehicle usage. One way is keeping track of business miles. Is there another way? Yeah, there is, Martin, and that is to do the actual expense method, which isn't so great. So either I'm doing 58 cents a mile or I am tracking all of my miles and figuring out what expense actually there was. All the gas, oil changes, repairs, add it all up. I used it 50% for business, 50% personal. I write myself a check for 50% of it. That's not nearly as good as doing the mileage, by the way. And then if you leave town for business, then yes, you get meals. It's 50% deductible, unless it's included in like your airplane ticket, your cruise ticket, your train ticket, whatever. And yeah, I didn't mean to say cruise. You can actually use a cruise ship for travel. Anyway, if a vehicle is being used as an investment only and in the business name, will that be allowed? Yeah. So Alan, if you're leasing it to somebody else, you're going to have sales tax on it too. So, but it's now you're actually using it just for business. You're not driving it around personally. If you are, then you still pay tax on whatever portion of that total mile I just put on there. So it's kind of weird. So let's say that I have three cars that I lease out to Uber drivers, but I drive them myself too. They take a look and say total miles put in the year, let's say it was 90,000 and I put 10,000 on for personal. So I have 1/9 of the values that I'm going to have to recognize in all three cars. They're going to say, what's the lease value of those vehicles? It might be $3,000 a month. Okay, I'm going to have to recognize 1/9 of that. So I just used a really bad example, but let's just say $400 a month. I'm going to have to recognize $400 a month because that's the personal use I got out. That's how the IRS does it. All right. I have rental properties already. Will they be taxed differently if they are part of a C corporation? Usually I file with my 1040. So if you put them in the C corp, don't do that. I'll just be real clear. Don't do that. It's not in your best interest. Capital gains are gone. If you take it out, it's a taxable event. Putting it in, it's not going to be taxable, but all your appreciation is no longer long-term capital gains. You lose all these benefits. So you can still 1031 exchange through C corp. Somebody asked me to explain what a 1031 exchange is. I'll just tell you, a 1031 exchange is a fancy way of saying selling real estate and buying more of equal or greater value. If you do that, you don't have to pay tax, but you have to use an intermediary. You have to complete that transaction with the 180 days, and there's a 45-day property identification process. You could do a reverse exchange and go backwards, but anyway, so I would not put it in the C corp. If a C corp is managing an LLC that is owning the real estate and you're paying it a management fee, that's fantastic. And yeah, that money will be taxed far differently. Mm-hmm. And usually it's used to expense things and get it back to you. It's like your home office and things like that. There's a bunch of other questions that aren't necessarily, is the LLC owning? Not necessarily. So I wouldn't have the C corp owning an LLC unless I'm flipping. Like the only time I do this is if I am buying property to sell it, that's the same thing as being a car lot. I'm buying cars to sell them. There's no such thing as long-term capital gains, installment sales. Yep, it's just inventory. Mm-hmm. And then I don't want to be taxed every time I sell a car. I want to be taxed at the end of the year based off of what's left in the company. And I don't want it. So I'm not going to do that individually. I'm going to make sure I'm doing that through either an S or a C corp. And then the C corp, by the way, go back to this. It files an 1120 in a completely different tax form, and it pays its own tax on its profit. What does somebody say? Realtor lease a car for use as a sales agent and rent it out as a Turo car. I don't know what a Turo car is. What's a Turo car, Mr. Ron? I don't know what that. Let's see. What is the deadline to elect S corp tax treatment for a single member LLC? That's interesting. The S corp tax treatment of a single member LLC, you'd have to choose to, as a single member LLC, it depends on who's the owner. If it's you, you actually have to make an election to be taxed as a corporation. And then the S election technically is supposed to be made by the 15th day of the third month following the beginning of that company.
Yeah, you have 75 days.
75 days.
75 days from the date of the effective date, the date you'd like the election to be effective. Is that what the question is?
No, they're just asking when's the deadline.
To be able to do the 2553.
Yeah, so yeah. The problem that you have is a single member LLC doesn't mean it's being taxed as a corp. Usually you have to tax it as a corp, so you're doing the 8832 saying tax as a corp.
Now they're saying you can go straight
to the 2553, mm-hmm. 75 days to do it?
75 days, but...
See, I knew you were a rock star. But,
and even if you're outside that 75 days, they do give late election relief.
Yeah, if you have a good reason why you were late, like, and you still treated it as an S corp, they'll let you keep it as an S corp. And a good reason could be
you didn't know you needed to file.
Yeah, I didn't know. My accountant screwed me up.
Wait,
Tony did it. It's all Tony. Let's see, ran out my car to the public. So Mr. Ron is talking about, hey, I have a car and I'm renting it out to the public. Then I might put it in an LLC, just keep it separate. But that's different. I'm also getting sales tax and other things when I'm leasing it. Turo might use it, so that might be a third-party service. And I'm not driving it. Somebody else is driving it. So now I'm looking at it saying, hey, I'm just going to keep that puppy separate from everything else that's going on. So I might do it under that circumstance. All right. Did I answer this one yet? Oh, yes. Oh, so when switching your LLC designated, this is bizarre because she just asked that question right before this, right? When switching your LLC designation to an S corp, what accounting changes should you make? Paying yourself unknown deduction. So the tax and bookkeeping is identical for all entities, whether you're a sole proprietor, an S corp, C corp, mm-hmm. LLC taxes an S corp, LLC taxes a partnership. You get the idea. It's all the same. So the accounting wouldn't change. The only thing that would change is if you went from an LLC that was a single owner to you or to something else, somebody else, and then it switched to an S corp. Now we have to worry about, hey, if we're taking distributions, are we paying ourselves a salary?
Right.
The other thing is, once you have an S corp, you can be an employee of that S corp. If you are an employee, you qualify for an accountable plan. If you qualify for an accountable plan, I can now reimburse you for tons of things that I can't do if you are a sole proprietor or a partnership. For example, I can reimburse for an administrative home office without having to do a home office schedule and file it on my Schedule C. I just get free money. I could reimburse myself for my cell phone. I could reimburse myself for anything that's in the house that I'm using for the benefit of the business, at least proportionality. So at least like on my house, good chance I'll be writing off 20% as a check from the S corp for ordinary expenses that goes to you that you don't have to recognize as tax. So it's free money. We like free money.
Yeah, free money is great.
Yeah, and 280A, which is another way to get a bunch of money. So let's see, how do I get my realtor broker to pay my S corp or LLC or C corp? Not sure it's set up yet. Alan, this is where it gets fun. A lot of brokers won't pay your LLC or your S corp or anything like that. What you do is there was a tax case where the IRS told us what to do. There's a letter that you provide your broker saying, hey, you work for your S corp. Your S corp gives you an employment agreement. And now even if they don't pay your S corp, you put it in your S corp. You treat it as though it was received by the S corp. You can't do that without that letter, without the letter and the employment agreement. But you do those and you're good as gold. Otherwise, you just have them pay directly to your company. It's like here in Nevada. They can pay an entity as long as the entity comports with the Realtor Association, the licensing.
Well, from what I've seen, it goes either way. I've had plenty of folks who their broker did go ahead and do it, mm-hmm. did go ahead and pay it, but like I was saying, there is a way around it. So
there is a way.
You just have to ask.
Yeah, and you have to just make sure you're documenting ahead of time. So in the case where, like, it's always a tax case, so somebody lost or somebody mm-hmm. won, and in this case, the guy lost, and it was because he didn't provide a letter. Like, the IRS said, well, if it had said this, mm-hmm. you'd have been fine, but it didn't. So all we do is we make sure that the letter we send says what they said it should say. So we just use their magic language. Hey, all right, we're under the exclusive control of the S Corp, and, you know, but even though you're not going to pay the S Corp. We know you're only going to pay me. It's actually, I'm 100% at the service of the S Corp. I'm an employee of the S Corp. You should be paying the S Corp even if you don't. Kind of fun stuff. Where do I get the letter? You got to come to TaxWise, my friend. We'll give you the letter. No, if you're Platinum, we'll give you whatever you need. So if you're a Platinum service member with Anderson, just email in. If you need the letter, just go to, you know, right into TaxTuesday@AndersonAdvisors.com. Make sure we get you squared away. What is your opinion on investment in the oil and gas space as a tax mitigation strategy? This is kind of fun. Not everybody has an opinion. So first off, it's an investment. Make sure that you could lose all your money in any investment. So I'm just going to say stuff like that. So not telling you to do this. Somebody says, does S Corp need to pay payroll taxes? Not necessarily. Only on the amount of wages you take. Everything else that flows down to you, you avoid Social Security or the self-employment tackle. You could also call it old age, death and survivors and Medicare if you want to get technical. It avoids about 14.1% when you actually do the math, and it ends up being really good. So S Corps are awesome. Yes, you have to pay some payroll taxes on only the payroll, as opposed to a sole proprietor where you pay payroll taxes on 100%
right.
of the self-employment tax.
That's why I love S Corps, because it gives you back the control mm-hmm. of how much you're going to put as payroll and how much you're going to just have come flow through, and you don't have to pay the payroll tax on that part or self-employment tax. So we have the control back now in our hands.
Yep. It even gets better. Somebody has said something about the 20% deduction. Yeah, you get to take the 20% deduction too on the income out of the S Corp. You do not get a 20% deduction on payroll. So you always want to do your math. I've broken this thing down painfully in detail. Whenever we do the TaxWise workshop, which we just did one last week, mm-hmm. just seems like yesterday, but I think it was last week or the week before that. Just did one, and yeah, we go through this over and over and over again. Do you have to take a salary out of an S Corp? Says Ron. Yes, if you take distributions. No, if you don't. So if I just have an S Corp and it makes $100,000 and I leave it in the S Corp, technically I don't have to take a salary. But if I make $100,000 and I take $50,000 out, I need to make sure that I am paying a portion of that as wages. So if it's $50,000, I'm probably paying myself a third of it as wages. But technically, if I don't take anything out of an S Corp, I don't technically have to pay myself a salary. Somebody says, what is the 20% deduction? It's called a 199A deduction. You can go to our site and look at it, but it's the qualified business income deduction that was under the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. So the Trump Tax Act. What it says is, A corporation's get a flat 21% tax if you're a C corp. If you're an S corp and you pass through the wages, or the not the wages, but if you pass through profits, it gets a 20% haircut under many circumstances. If it's any pass through, so a partnership, sole proprietors even qualify, but there's some different tests. If you draw a profit out the following year, do you have to, and you have no problem the corporation, do you have to take it as a salary? John, you're getting smart. You took the distribution out in a following year, but you had no tax. You're going to create a loss and you'd have basis. So you'd be able to take it as a loss. You'd create a loss for yourself. So it wouldn't be that you have no profit. It's just, if I take a salary, it's going to be an expense in excess of any profit I have. So I'd still get to write it off. Let's go back to this. What is your opinion on investments in oil and gas? So the way oil and gas, reason people invest in it a lot for tax purposes, is that intangible drilling costs, the cost of digging your hole in the earth to pull out the oil and all that goes along with it, is 100% deductible against your ordinary income. So if somebody, let's say they have a salary of $500,000 and they know, oh shoot, I'm in a really bad tax state. I'm in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Maryland, California, you know, some state with a high state tax. And they say, gosh, my federal tax is high. My state tax is high. I'm paying essentially 50 cents on the dollar. If I invest that $100,000, I'm going to save 50,000 of it if I end up with some loss. So if I invest $100,000 and get $100,000 deduction, then I'm getting a 50%, you know, return right away. So that's why people do it. I wouldn't invest in oil and gas simply for the tax mitigation, because then you have no deduction on the depletion, or you lose that portion of it. So like you're going to end up paying the tax in the long run anyway, but people do it because they want the deduction now. It's worth it something to them. So even if the investment doesn't make you anything, I'm getting a nice fat deduction. So I could invest $100,000 into oil and gas, but it's only costing me really 50. So that's the way they kind of look at it. Somebody says, I have a 1099 job. Can I form an S corp to avoid the self-employment tax? The income in my 1099 is for investment purposes. Okay, so first off, if you have a 1099 job, that's not a job. You're not an employee, you're a contractor. So if you're a contractor, could you run that into an S corp? Yeah, and avoid a bunch of the self-employment tax. That's exactly why people do it. So yes, you could. Great question. All right, I have a full-time job, W-2, and I do real estate investing on the side. How can I use property depreciation to deduct against the W-2 income? Tony, what do you say?
Well, it depends on your adjusted gross income. So if you have depreciation that's resulting in rental real estate losses, that can be deductible against your W-2 income up to $25,000 and starts to phase out at $100,000 of your adjusted gross income. Or you can qualify as a real estate professional, in which case you'd be able to take all of your rental losses against your ordinary income or W-2 income.
Mm-hmm. Right. So since 1986, they closed this wonderful loophole. All the rich guys and gals out there would buy real estate and then they would depreciate them really fast and hard and offset their income. So Mr. Doctor out there making $500,000 would invest in real estate, so he didn't have to pay tax. So they said, oh, that's a tax shelter. This is so unfair. So they said, if you're an investor in real estate, it's passive if it's investment real estate. And then they said, you can only use your passive losses against your passive income. So that was rule number one. So if I have a bunch of real estate and I depreciate it and I end up with $100,000 of loss, I can only offset my rental income with it. Now there's two exceptions. What Tony said is 100% correct. If you make $100,000, then you could be an active participant in real estate, which means you hire the manager or you manage the property, and you get to write off up to $25,000 of depreciation or loss against your other income. So my W-2 income, whatever income. Now, if you're above that, and I always say that depends. Somebody's, you guys are goofy out there, right? So let's say that somebody, you're making $200,000, you're phased out of the $25,000, and you have a bunch of real estate losses. Then the only way you're going to get to write that loss off personally, first off, you can carry it forward into future years to offset future passive income. But if I want to take it against my other income, so I have my W-2 income, and I want to offset whatever I have, I could do some accelerated depreciation or cost seg, and I get lots of extra loss, then I have to qualify as a real estate professional. And only one spouse has to qualify. And then you can take it on a joint return. Mm-hmm. And again, that rule is real simple. One spouse has to spend at least 750 hours, and it has to be their number one use of their professional time. So if I have a job, full-time job, then I do 2,000 hours a year, I'd have to do 2,001 hours of real estate, or I don't meet test number one. And then test number two is the material participation. So like the example I always give is if I'm a real estate broker, obviously I meet the 750 hours because I'm a real estate broker. But then if I do nothing with my own properties, and let's say I have three other properties and I do nothing and all I do is, you know, hire it out, I'm not a real estate professional. I'm not going to meet the material participation test. It has to be at least, you know, in that particular case, it would have to be at least 100 hours a year. And if I do nothing, I wouldn't meet it.
Right.
But if I did, and it could be one spouse. So let's say that one spouse is, I use a successful lawyer making, I'll use the a real life example, making $3 million a year. And the spouse is a real estate agent who specializes in commercial, and the lawyer's buying everything he can get his hands on because he knows that if he depreciates it heavily, he can offset his $3 million of income. That's exactly what he did. He got it down to zero. So, and he got audited as a result because it was so extreme, and he won because it was clear his wife qualified. So it only had to be one. So we have a bunch. Casino winnings and losses, you can write off your losses against your winnings unless you're a professional gambler. It's kind of weird.
Well, yeah. I mean, but with the doubling of the standard deduction and...
Does that go on Schedule A?
It does.
Oh, yeah. So don't gamble.
Or do it well.
Yeah. So if you make a whole bunch of money at it, then what is that going on your Schedule C? Or where's your gambling?
That's just other income.
Let's see. Are self-employed real estate professional property appraisers considered real estate professionals and able to meet the material participation test? So again, there's real estate professional test number one, which is 750 hours, and material participation test, which is about your properties. So if you're an appraiser, you probably aren't in the transactional world. That time probably wouldn't qualify as real estate professional time. The same way as I am a lawyer who does nothing but like asset protection and taxes with real estate, but I would never qualify as a real estate professional because I do a bunch of other stuff too. So your appraising isn't a real estate activity. As weird as that sounds. Then somebody says, oh, $7,000 of loss. Well, keep in mind that whenever you're doing gambling, you can only take your losses up against your wins unless you qualify as a professional gambler. And that's like a weird test, right? So my guess is that you're just carrying that forward to future years when you might admit it back. Most people that gamble and lose don't get it as a write-off. What are the common tax deductions that apply to real estate investors? So the basic ones is you're buying real estate. So you're going to have real estate taxes. You're going to have closing fees. You're going to have, if you have mortgage interest, if you have loans, you're going to have repair expenses. You're going to have depreciation if you're holding properties. And by the way, repair expenses, you have a safe harbor of $2,500, you know, for the area of the home that's getting fixed. If you take something that's broken and fix it, it's a repair. If you take something that's long in the tooth and make it new again, then that is an improvement. So if I put a new roof on a house, that's an improvement. That's not a repair. If I fix a hole in the roof, that's a repair. So I write off repairs. I add improvements to my basis. I don't get to write it off right away. Other tax deductions. So the depreciation is a big one. I'm taking the actual structure that I put on and doing it.
And sometimes people get confused with the depreciation. Say, you know what? I don't want to take any depreciation because I don't want to have to recognize the depreciation recapture. Well, whether you take the depreciation or not, you are going to have to recognize the depreciation recapture on that. So take the depreciation deduction.
Yeah. What Tony just said is actually like a mean thing that they do. Here's the scenario. Husband and wife own a house. They have a piece of rental property, not even rental property. They had a vacation home and they rent it out and they say, hey, I'm going to rent it half the time I'm not there. The rest of the time we're going to go spend our summers on the lake on this beautiful property. You're entitled to the depreciation, whether you take it or not. The fact that you were renting that out for more than 14 days a year, the IRS says that's a rental property. You have to recapture the depreciation, whether or not you wrote it off. It's kind of mean. Carpet replacement, you'll be able to write that off. This Mr. Ron had $7,000 of wins. Where would you put that on in gambling? Just other income?
It's other income, yeah.
So it goes on as 1040 page one.
Yep.
Good job, Mr. Ron. How about a loan? I always think that when somebody wins, you can borrow some money.
And just to this question we have up as well, what I see is, and what I look for if I'm reviewing your return, is I'm looking to see if you have management fees on there or if you have auto travel expenses on there. If you don't have one, you should have the other or both.
Hey, carpet. We're writing that off just because it's such a short period of time, right? We're bonus depreciating it?
Yes.
Right. So Mina, anything less than 20 years, you can write off in year one. So if you have carpet, paint, all that stuff, you're writing it off. You have to call it a repair. Mm-hmm. It's just a deductible item.
Are you looking to lower your taxes, protect your assets, and grow your wealth? Are you a real estate investor, stock trader, or business owner? If you answered yes, Anderson Advisors Tax and Asset Protection Workshop is for you. Let host Clint Coons, Toby Mathis, and Michael Bowman teach you how to protect and keep more of what you earn. Our workshops are held monthly throughout the country and via live stream. Two in-person tickets to the workshop are only $99. To learn more about the dates and locations, visit AndersonAP.com and register today.
All right, so that's real estate investors. Oh, by the way, one that we didn't cover is management fees. So you can always pay it up. Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, you're smart. So you can always throw the corporation in there to manage the thing and pay it a bunch of money. So I must have been vegging on that part. If you get dinged for depreciation in the year of sale on an undepreciated property, can you go back previous years and claim the depreciation? So think about this. If somebody does not depreciate, they could have depreciated, but they don't. They sell the property, they have depreciation recapture on depreciation they never took. If it's within 3 years, they could go back and amend the return to take the depreciation.
Yes, actually. And you don't even have to go back and amend if it was multiple years. You don't have to go back and amend every year. IRS made it a little bit easier for us to just put it on a schedule and catch that up.
So you can catch it up. So Bruce, good catch. You can write it off. What are common tax deductions for a futures trader from home? MJ, that's funny because futures traders, yeah, first off, you get some nice tax treatments, like 60% long-term capital gains, 40% capital gains, but you don't get any unless you set it up as a business, and then you'd have to have an LLC tax as a partnership with a corporation as the manager. But topic, there's a bunch of videos on the site. I'd watch that. So you want to make sure that you are not just sitting home doing futures trading. It's not going to give you any tax benefits. Mm-hmm. If you're going to do futures trading, like what I really would do is do it in a retirement account, or I would set up a corporation. If I'm small account, like less than 10,000, if I'm over that, I'm setting up an LLC tax as a partnership with the corporation as a partner and also as a manager. All right. When finishing a rehab with the intent to sell, what is the best way to minimize capital gains tax? Yeah, somebody has said I do mine under the C-Corp. Perfect, because I'm just going to zero that puppy out anyway. So first off, we have a rehab with intent to sell. So there's no such thing as capital gains tax. It's inventory. Right. You just sold Cheerios and you're a grocery store. Or I just sold a car and I'm a car lot. However you want to talk it. Mm-hmm. It's ordinary income. So if I want to minimize the capital gains tax, then flip houses because there is none. That's just mean. All right. So what I want to do is I want to have that in an S corp or a C corp to minimize my total tax. Mm-hmm. So in all seriousness, what you do is you never do flips in your name, personal name. You don't want it on your personal return. You're going to do it under a C corp or an S corp, and I'm going to aggregate them all together and have all of my gains and all of my losses at the end of the year, as opposed to transaction by transaction, which you would have as an individual. Plus, if I make that money in an individual, I'm paying self-employment tax on all of it, which has the nasty habit of making my taxes way more.
You can also go back several questions ago. Mm-hmm. How do I minimize my tax? Set up a tax deferral vehicle.
Yep. Since you don't have capital gains, I could use a 401k now. So I could set up a company and I could minimize my tax completely. I could jam, I'm over 50. I'm jamming, what, 25,000 into this, the first $25,000 a gain plus 25% of whatever I decide to pay myself. So it's kind of fun. At what point is the intent established and is it documented somewhere? It's facts and circumstances. So they look at what you do. So if you buy houses all the time and you fix them up and sell them, they're going to call you a flipper, that you're a dealer. If I do it once in a while, then they're going to look at the total activity that you do, and they're going to say, what is your primary intent? And they're going to look at it from facts and circumstances.
Yeah, it is documentation as well, because you actually can change the intent. Mm-hmm. Like if you purchase a property with the intent to sell it, and let's just say, you know, the market took a dive, and mm-hmm. now is not the best time to sell it. So you change the intent of that property to hold it and wait for it to appreciate. Now I'm changing it from inventory to a capital asset. Mm-hmm. But just documenting it and showing, like, well, the comps in the area, industry saying this, the market's saying mm-hmm. this right now.
Well, you got to be careful. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to disagree with you. I'm just going to say that there's a case out there. Mm-hmm. In 2006, a guy bought a building and he was going to fix it up and sell it. And then 2007 happened. And all of a sudden, they couldn't sell it. And so what the court did, because this was actually a court case, is they looked at every year And every year he would get an appraisal on the building and say, is it time to sell? Is it time to sell? And he sold it in 2017 and ended up being a wonderful tax court case.
But did he change it to a business property?
It was already, when he bought it, mm-hmm. he was intending to sell it. Mm-hmm. So it was held in the same entity the whole time. But what they said is, was that a dealer property or was it an investment property? I think mm-hmm. he did an installment sale. And so my guess is, and I forget the amount at issue, but it was a few hundred thousand, is they nixed his ability to recognize that over time. Mm-hmm. So he got nailed with the tax on money he never received yet. Like, he will receive it, but it's always fun when they do that. But it was 10 years a hold. So you're going to want to make sure that if you're flipping, so here's the way you do it. It's real easy, actually. It's what all the accounting journals will tell you. You buy your flips in a corporation, you buy your holds, and you use LLCs. If, you know, and by the way, your corporation is a tax designation. So it could be an LLC tax as an S or a C corp. If you're doing your buy and holds, it's a flow to your return on your Schedule E, either as a disregarded entity or as a partnership. So that way the IRS knows exactly what you're doing. And if you accidentally buy something in a C corp or an S corp that you're going to flip, and then you decide you're going to hold it, you sell it to your holding entity or vice versa. If you buy it and you think you're going to hold on to it for a long time, sell it and grab your long-term capital gains before you fix it up and make it into a flipper. Because there's nothing worse than losing long-term capital gains, which have a cap of 20%, by making it ordinary income where your cap is 37%. Mm-hmm. So you just use those two entities and treat it just like you would they were just buddies that you know, and not just you. And I would sell it. You can even do that with your house. We talk about this a lot. People that have had their houses forever, not much value, you know, they didn't pay much for it, but now it's worth quite a bit. And they want to use their 121 exclusion, which is the, I don't have to pay tax on my house up to $500,000 of capital gains when I sell it. If I'm married, $250,000 if I'm single. You sell the house to your S corp and then let the S corp hold it. As long as you're never going to sell it, we don't really care. And your basis steps up so you can depreciate it at a much higher amount. It ends up being really a good way to do it. We're going along. I do my flips on LLC, but that LLC is disregarded by C corp. Is that fine? Yes, Chris, because the tax designation of that LLC is the C corp. All right. Will an LLC help reduce rental property taxes? The answer is rental property taxes, probably not, unless you have a corporation that's in with it. And we could always play games with this. How is that LLC taxed? So if it's rental properties, I don't want it to be taxed as an S or a C corp, but I probably want to have a manager managing that, and then I could reduce my taxes. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of fun. Anything you want to add?
No, I think that's pretty straightforward.
See, Tony's such a good accountant. She wanted to say it depends on how you're going to tax the LLC. I ruined it for her.
Well, you kind of said that.
But I know you wanted to say it. She was chomping at the bit. She started laughing.
Yeah.
Anytime we see LLC, we know what we can do. How would it work with C corps involved? The C corp would be the manager, and the C corp has another tax designation. So I could pay, you know, management fees to the C corp. It's no longer that rent would no longer flow onto my return and be taxed to me. It'd be taxed at a C corp level. Let's say I had a bunch of profit or the rents were positive. So I was making $20,000 a year. Let's say I'm a taxpayer in the highest bracket. That $20,000 a year is going to get nailed at 37% plus my state tax. If I kick it over to the corporation, then the corporation pays 21% on it. So it's going to pay $4,000 as opposed to much higher. And there's lots of ways to get money out of a corp that's tax-free. Which is more tax advantageous, a 1031 exchange or a charitable remainder trust? You want to nail this one?
Well, I think it depends on what the asset is. So if it's real property, then you have the opportunity to use a 1031 exchange. Because a 1031 exchange under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is limited now to only real property.
That's a big one. 1031 exchanges are only for real property now, mm-hmm. no longer for business inventory.
You want to pick up the charitable?
No, you do the charitable remainder trust. You think I want to do the charitable remainder trust?
You're doing the charitable remainder.
All right. Here's the big difference. So in a 1031 exchange, and we like that joshing around. 1031 exchange is a deferral. I'm kicking it out until the end of time. If I die owning that real estate, the basis steps up. If I 1031 exchange properties my entire life, I'll never pay tax on the capital gains or the depreciation recapture. When I die, the basis steps up and my heirs will no longer pay taxes on any of that growth as of the date of my death. In a charitable remainder trust, well, just think of what it is. It's trust with charity as a remainder interest. So I get a deduction based on the value of whatever I put into that charitable remainder trust and what it's going to be worth in the future. So if I give, let's say it's not a house, but let's just say it's What if I gave a bunch of Bitcoin? That'd be kind of fun, since Bitcoin is technically a capital asset and it just jumped up, what, 300% this year. It keeps doing weird stuff. Mm-hmm. So let's say that I gave a charitable manager trust a bunch of Bitcoin. I get a deduction based on off of a percentage. I'm going to say close to 10% of the value. It's not huge, because they look and say, hey, how long is this thing going to be in trust before their charity gets their interest? So, and it's going to be spent down. Like, I'm going to get income off this thing my entire life. Under most charitable remainder unit trust, I'm getting an amount every year that I get to receive, or I can roll forward and not pay tax on it. But I want to make sure that I have the right to receive income off this thing. So let's say I have Bitcoin that's worth $200,000. I throw it in a charitable remainder trust. I'm probably going to get about a $20,000 deduction this year as a charitable deduction. It goes into trust. The entire $200,000, let's say I sell the Bitcoin and turn it into US dollars, no tax. And then as it grows and as it makes money, I might be kicking out a certain percentage of that, let's say, 3% or something like that a year. And I'm going to pay tax only on that amount that I receive, the income that it's generating. And then when I pass, the remainder interest, the remainder holder is a charity. And technically, it could be my own charity. So some people use it. And the reason they're using it is if they have highly appreciated assets. So it's pretty cool. So what's more tax advantageous? Frankly, I'm going to tell you 1031 exchange is always going to be better. Share remainder trust, you're going to have income your whole life. And, frankly, they're a bit of a sticky wicket. We don't do too many of them because there's such a complexity to it. And nobody really wants to give it all away. Mm-hmm. I'd rather just give it to a charity now and take the full deduction. And then if I want to pay myself income, I can, rather than force myself to do it. So I tend to stay away from charitable remainder trust, and I'd rather just go straight to the charity. And then I'll go ahead and give the assets to the charity. So my same example, $20,000 worth of Bitcoin, I give it to a charity, I can write the full $20,000 off. Even if it's my charity, now I turn that into cash, I got $20,000 that I'm doing what I want to do. Maybe I can give it to my church, whatever. It's oftentimes better to do it that way than paying a taxable event on the Bitcoin and giving the dollars, me having to recognize the capital gains, than me giving it away.
Yeah.
I'm getting both. If you guys get a pen out, you'll realize what I'm saying and go, whoa. How do you take money out of a corporation without having to pay taxes? You reimburse yourself under an accountable plan, Mina. You're going to write off literally anything that you incur personally for the benefit of that company, including education, cell, utilities, internet, car, a home office, 280A, equipment, your computers, all sorts of fun stuff. And then if it's a C corp, even your medical, dental, and vision, even your long-term care. And yes, you can write off long-term. Somebody asked this way a long time ago. I didn't answer it, but long-term care policies, you have restrictions on what you can write off as an individual, and then you still have to exceed 10% of your adjusted gross income. If it's through a C corp, I can write the whole thing off from dollar one if it's qualified long-term care. How often should you take a distribution from a holding LLC? As often as you like, but not on a regular basis. Yeah, if somebody says vitamins, co-pays, prescriptions, yes, yes, maybe. The vitamins, you just got to make sure a doctor gives you says you should take them. So you want something in writing from a doc on that, because then it qualifies. What about an S corp? No, S corp, if you pay yourself stuff that is health related, it's considered income to you. It's considered wages. You can still write off the insurance premiums individually as self-employed insurance premiums, but all the other stuff, the co-pays, deductibles, non-covered items, all that is actually income. So it has to be a C corp. Let's see, in a flip corporation, can you have an LLC taxed as an S and simply pay yourself a salary to reduce the employment tax? Well, your salary won't reduce the employment tax because you're still paying it. It's just not the self-employment tax. You're paying the employer and the employee sides of old age, death, and survivors and Medicare. So that's not going to do it. What you do is you pay yourself a very small salary, and then the distributions are not subject to the self-employment tax. All right. So let's get back to this distributions from a holding LLC. You don't want it to be a pattern, because then a court could say, hey, you're always giving money every month. You need to keep giving money any month. So you want to make sure it's sporadic, but there's no tax event when you're taking a distribution from a holding LLC. If it's disregarded mm-hmm. or taxed as a partnership, it's like a safe. You can put money in it, take it out, put money in it, take it out. Somebody says, what about athletic club memberships for a C corp? Listen, you have to get a doctor to prescribe it, then yes. Otherwise, no. So athletic club memberships, I wish they were deductible. But if your doctor says, hey, Alyssa, you got some stress, girl, let's get you, like, you need to go in there and push some iron, get them to write it up. Then you can reimburse yourself. And you could be a beast. My wife does all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
My wife, like, she kills it. She goes in every day. She says, I'm in the office. she does it. Somebody says yes. All right. What, if any, are the tax benefits for real estate investors in Florida to use a trust to hold real estate? So that's a great question because it illustrates a point. The trust is, you want to make sure that you know what trust you're using. So are there any tax benefits for an investor in Florida to use a trust to hold real estate? There's only one that I can think of, and that is when you use a land trust and you're using a LLC to hold the beneficial interest and it's rental, and I have a corporation as the manager. Or if I'm flipping property, then I'll use the trust and point it towards an LLC tax as an S corp or a C corp. But the trust itself gives you no tax benefit. Trusts usually are going to be revocable trusts, and we're probably going to ignore them. I really don't want to get too far into these things. Even if you have an irrevocable trust, like I sometimes use Nevada asset protection trusts, and I set them up and make them intentionally defective for tax purposes, so not to create an extra tax return, because trust taxation, if it's trust and estates, it's taxed really bad. What is it? It's like the highest tax bracket, you're at $11,000, you're already there. So we don't want to do that. We want it to flow down to you. All right. How should money flow from personal to business back to personal in the most tax efficient manner? All right. So here's how it works. Let's say that I put money into a holding company and take it back out. Zero tax, no benefit. Let's say that I put money into a C corp and the C corp ends up reimbursing me and I create a loss in the C corp. No benefit to me other than I get money back out to me. The money's tax free, but it's not a deduction to me. Now the deduction's stuck in the C corp. If it makes any other monies, that's good because now it's not going to pay tax on it. Let's say that I put money into an S corp and then it reimburses me for a bunch of expenses and it creates a loss. Fantastic. I get those losses. The answer becomes this horrible thing. The two words you guys hate hearing, which is it depends. It really, like, how should money flow back and forth? You got to work with a tax professional to say how we want to get money where. So if I have, this is a good example. If I have personal money, I put it in a corporation. The corporation makes some money, puts it into a 401k. The 401k grows for 30 years, and then it starts paying me out at 70.5, some minimum distributions. And I pay at my rate then a pretty light tax. That's the really tax efficient manner to get the money back out. And I've had decades of tax-free growth. That's pretty good. And I did that by taking my money and dumping it into a corporation so it could make some money. But every little situation is different. Somebody says, should the management corporation be an S or a C corp? It depends on whether you have an S or a C corp floating around, what your tax bracket is, and what your tax appetite is. So it really gets down, I hate saying it depends because we say it a lot, but it really does. It's facts and circumstances. And the IRS is going to tell you the same thing when they look at stuff. So I look and see what's your tax appetite. If you want to know your tax appetite, this is a good transition. Your TaxWise workshop. I went over on June 13th and 14th. What a great group that was. We had over 100 some odd people, even online. We had a full house in live, and we did over 30 tax strategies in detail. And you can get that recording of both that one and the one we did in January, which was kind of a beginning of the year. And then November, we're going to do an end of the year tax planning TaxWise. You can get that whole thing, all three of them, including attending the live stream. You can watch in November the live class and ask all the questions you want. You can go to andersonadvisors.com/3-for-1. It's $197 and you get it all. You get all three. I started that in January. I happen to think it's probably the best deal in town because I have quite literally had people go to this in January, and already I've had a $178,000 winner where somebody says that they were able to get that type of tax benefit. I had a guy this weekend who had gone to one on CostSeg and found $130,000 of deductions this year that he's actually going to be able to use every dollar on. And he was like, I didn't even know you could do that. And guess what? He learned one thing. I always tell people there's 31 deductions that we went over, like tax strategies. I said, pick three. Pick three. If it doesn't pay for itself, I'll give you your money back. No problem. But this will absolutely put a ton of money back in your pocket. It's $197. It's ridiculously low for what is 2 days of intense tax deductions and tax strategies. iTunes. Like, if you guys like the Tax Tuesday, we break them into and make them into podcasts. So here, you guys can go back. Somebody's asked for the address. Patty can give it to you as well. It's andersonadvisors.com/3-for-1. If you just email us too, you can say, hey, I want to do the 3-for-1. We've had hundreds of people do it. And the responses has been great. I wish I could say thousands, but we've had thousands of people go through our workshops, but not everybody loves the taxes. Some people just like to go to the workshops and think about it, but not everybody loves taxes. I love taxes. Tony, you love taxes?
Yes.
You love to hate them? She loves dealing with them. All right. So then you go to iTunes, Anderson Business Advisors, and you could watch and listen to a bunch of the old Tax Tuesdays and this one as well. We have a very special guest here with us, with Tony. She's not always with us. How many of these have you done?
This is my second one.
This is your second one. So mm-hmm. Jeff always jumps. See, Jeff likes to sit here and he's talking loudly with his eyes. He doesn't vocalize, but I can tell he wants to say things all the time. No, I'm a Hobart, so I just blah, 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 blah. All right, you could do that on Google Play. You could do Anderson Business Advisors, jump on the podcast. Oh, I forgot about this. We've been doing this for the last couple of months. Go to the Infinity Investing Workshop and sign up. You get a free you get a free code to do an 11-part. How do I find an EA? You call up a tax group like us and you say, do you have any EAs? Let's see what else. You've done a job telling me all those over the last 10 years. I like that. We have some clients here that have been with us 20, 10, a lot of years. So Infinity Investing, this is a get rich slowly. And if you like more of a methodical approach towards making money and looking at things, you use that code free tax. It's an 11-part series. It's very much something that I designed and built for younger people, especially 20, 21, 18. Before they get in and develop a bunch of bad habits, and they want to understand what an asset is versus what a liability is from a very easy to understand but hard to screw up way. And I talk about the losing loop, how to use when you're buying a liabilities with liabilities, and when you're able to figure that one out, you realize when somebody's duping it into something, then this is great. It is free. So when it says free tax, it is free. There's no strings. It's 11-part series, and I think I have another 5 hours of financial stewardship built in there. I have a very simple philosophy, which is if it's really not yours. So the simple philosophy is you treat it like it's somebody else's, then you quit doing goofy things with your money. If I win money down at the casino, I treat it very differently than if I did something else. And if I send you 18, use this and have them pop on in, more than happy. And if somebody paid for it, yeah, I'll give you a credit on that. I forgot that I had this in there. Sometimes I give stuff away and I forget that I'm giving away. Somebody says, yes, needs versus desires. Yep. So we actually break it down mathematically. So this is funny. Infinity Investing, in a nutshell, is this. There's a certain amount of money that I live on a daily basis. If that money comes in without me having to work for it, then I don't ever have to work again. So if I live off of $200 a day and I have $210 coming in from rents, royalties, dividends, interest, something that's passive, then I never have to work again. I could live an indefinite period of time without having to do a bunch of work. That's infinity. So when I look at your net worth, I don't care how much you have. I care how many days you could live without working. That's it. And if it's less than infinity, then we got work to do. If you could do that in an indefinite period of time, fantastic. Then we worry about giving it away and how you create a legacy that where they can't screw it up, because kids will screw it up. I'm just telling you, it's about a 16% likelihood that they'll actually be successful with your money. It's really, really small. Federal rent checks, don't know what that is. Never heard about it. And chances are it's fake. If somebody says, is that real? I don't know. It sounds weird. Federal rent check. What I'm thinking of is that's called a HUD. So it might be Section 8, and that is real, where the feds pay for your property. And the beautiful part about HUD is it could be for profit or not for profit. If you don't want to pay tax on it, you don't have to. Tax Tuesday at Anderson Advisors, or visit us online. Yeah, do the Google, do all that fun stuff. And this will become your favorite thing to do every 2 weeks. Yes, we have some weird groups that do the Tax Tuesday parties. I hope they drink a lot during it, because we didn't drink at all.
We didn't.
No. So next time we're cracking a bottle and we'll get a little crazy. All right, guys. Really appreciate you joining us. Do you have anything you want to add, Miss Chatty Cathy?
No, I think I'm good.
The accountants, they just sit here, and it's like my cats. They just sit here and look at me. Every now and again, they go, man. That's like Peaches.
Therapy for your cat.
No, you're better than a cat. No, my cats are awesome, though. Have you ever seen Peaches?
No.
What? Oh, my God. I got the best cats. All right. Do I want to do this every week? It depends. All right. That I don't know what I should drink. Hey, that's how they write the laws. It's drunk third graders. That's why, and they write it in crayon. And somebody says, is this the same material as in the November? No, it's a little more. And we fill in some of the blanks, but absolutely, it's the same philosophies. It's just I did it all. It's 11 part series, and it's all there's no audience participation, so it's 11 hours of content or 11 parts of content. I think it might be over 11 hours, but anyway, there's tons there. Till next time, guys, really appreciate you joining us. Share it with your friends. There's never any cost to doing a Tax Tuesday. Feel free to bring them in and asking any questions that they can get us. Thank you again, Ms. Covey, for coming in here and spending some time with us. It's not the easiest thing in the whole world for an accountant to come in and answer any questions.
Because it depends.
Because it always depends. Leave it at that. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast, and if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.